Today on Maine Calling, 1924 and its lessons for today. 100 years ago, change was in the air. The world was recovering from a deadly global epidemic. Immigration was one of the biggest political issues of the day. The richest families in the country were rapidly accumulating unimaginable wealth. And yep, it was an election year. Sound familiar? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn the clocks back to 1924 for a history lesson that has more than a little resonance right now. An immigration law passed that year would shape the United States population for decades to come. Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act, though in Maine, that didn't mean the right to vote in state elections. And the Roaring Twenties precipitated a cultural divide between new thinking and old. 1924 on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What were the notable events and moments 100 years ago in Maine? How does what was happening then resonate today? Our panel of historians will explain why the year 1924 was a significant one and one worth spending some time thinking about. Joining me, Kenneth C. Davis, who is a best-selling author and historian known for his Don't Know Much About History series, and Earl Shuttleworth, longtime Maine State historian. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to two of my favorite guests. I'm going to start by asking you, Kenneth C. Davis, if you will take us back to 1924. What did it feel like to live back then? What was sort of the zeitgeist of 1924 in America?
Hi, Jen. Always a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me. And of course, 1924, in many ways, has parallels to 2024. It also has some lessons for us. But the immediate concern, I think, for most Americans was getting back to normal. In fact, Warren Harding had run on that idea in 1920. America had come out of World War One. It had been a devastating war for the entire world. We had also just come through the devastating Spanish flu, as it was known back then, the influenza pandemic of 1918, the most deadly pandemic in world history since the Black Plague. So Americans were somewhat fearful and somewhat concerned with getting back to what they thought of as normal. And that meant a return to very conservative principles in many respects. We got prohibition in this time, an idea driven primarily by Christian Protestants who thought that alcohol was responsible for all the crime and degeneracy in America. But we also had this tremendous movement towards isolationism, that the problems that America had, both the war and the flu, had come because of Europe and allowing Europeans to come here, especially Europeans of a certain area. And that was the real motivating force for what would become an incredibly important piece of legislation, the Immigration Act of 1924. It was all based on fear, keeping out dangerous ideas, keeping out the other major factor at this time we have to consider is that the rise of the Soviet Union. Western democracies and monarchies feared that the rise of Bolshevism, the rise of Stalin, and the rise of the communists in Russia and the Soviet Union were going to continue to spill over west And that was another motivating force for what was going on to keep Europeans, especially Europeans from the eastern part of the world, out of America. They wanted a return to Europeans of a Nordic stock. And if that sounds familiar, it was. And it's also the year that Adolf Hitler went to prison and wrote Mein Kampf.
Wow. Okay. Earl, I'm going to have you bring this to Maine. I read that in 1920, it was the first census that more Americans lived in urban areas than rural areas. I don't think that was the case in Maine, though, was it?
Oh, no. In Maine, the 1920 census reflects that we had about 770,000 people, slight increase over 1910. And the traditional industries, which actually are reflected on the state seal, the farmer, the fisherman, the lumberman, those activities were still very strong in the Maine economy. But the lumbering was particularly geared to the paper industry, which had developed the pulp paper industry after the Civil War and was a major force in parts of Western Maine. And then in addition to that, another traditional industry, which had started before the Civil War, was the manufacture of textiles, particularly in big textile manufacturing centers like Biddeford Saco, Lewiston, and Augusta and Waterville. Now, some of the traditional industries that had sustained Maine in the 19th and early 20th century were changing. One of them was the granite industry, because technology was changing in terms of construction. There was a great deal of steel frame concrete construction taking place with high-rise buildings in the urban areas, and less of a of an interest in using the traditional granite industry. Another big force after World War I in the 1920s in Maine was auto tourism. There had been, again, tourism in Maine since before the Civil War, with many great summer hotels and summer resorts in the late 19th, early 20th century. But the automobile, now available to large numbers of the middle class, was really making a difference in the way people traveled and spent their vacations.
So when we think of 1924, we think of motels popping up along Route 1 and billboards and maybe sort of the heyday of places like Old Orchard Beach, York Beach, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. All you have to do is look at the old postcards and photographs, say from an area from, say, Kittery up to Portland, or Portland up to Brunswick, and you will find that in the 20s there was a proliferation of tourist camps, auto camps, tourist cabins, little restaurants, gas stations, billboards. All of these were things that really had not existed at the dawn of the 20th century, but became staples of travel in the 1920s and 30s.
Before we talk more specifically about specific acts of Congress and the presidential election, Ken, I want to go back to something you said about the conservatism generally of the people in the country. Wasn't there a bit of a cultural divide, if you will, between the conservatives and what we think of now as the roaring 20s, the young women who were cutting their hair and wearing short skirts? And yes, there was prohibition, but boy, there were speakeasies and there was jazz music. We were seeing a cultural divide and also urban-rural divide, weren't we?
That's completely accurate, because all of those things that we think of as jazz age society, flappers, the music, dancing the Charleston, those were really in the cities probably a very few cities, but they captured the public imagination. The rest of the country was moving far more towards the conservatism I mentioned, and that was reflected in a lot of things like the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s was reaching the height of its powers and reach, and not just in the former Confederacy. That plays into this whole question of immigration, because we think of the Ku Klux Klan purely in terms of racism against Black Americans. But remember, they were also opposed to immigrants and to Catholics. This was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant conservative movement, as Prohibition was. So you do have these two competing forces. And it's all amplified by what I spoke of earlier, the fear of what had happened in the Great War from 1914 to 1918, although the U.S. was only involved in the war for about a year's time. It was extremely costly. The fear of socialism and communism. So we had the first Red Summer, where people who were socialists were being deported to Russia. These were all aspects of the far more conservative side of things, very much at odds with the Jay Gatsby image of America in the Roaring Twenties.
I want to have Earl, you talk about Maine and the Ku Klux Klan in 1924, but we do have a caller who wants to talk about that. So we'll go to him. Ralph calling from Portland. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hi, Earl. It's Ralph. I'm not sure if you remember me. I can't give my last name, but the KKK expanded nationwide. I know that Mr. David is probably familiar with Tim Egan's A Fever in the Heartland, where the empire was developed in the state of Indiana. It took off from Maine to California. I'm curious as to what effect it had on Maine politics and Maine people during the 1920s, because I note that Maine's Senator Edmund Muskie's father changed his name from a post name to the name Muskie. So I'll let you guys elaborate and get offline. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Ralph, for your call. Earl.
Yes. The caller is absolutely right, and particularly the election of the fall of 1924. So what we need to remember is that Maine was still on this system of having their elections in September, a couple months before the November election in other parts of the country. Thus, the old phrase, as Maine goes, so goes the nation, in terms of getting an early reading on what might be happening politically. But back to the point. The Klan emerged in Maine in the early 1920s, and it was really at its height in the mid-20s, particularly in its effect on the 1924 election. It's estimated, although we'll never know exactly, that there might have been somewhere between 20 and 40,000 members. Now, how the effect occurred was that Governor Baxter declared that he was not going to seek an additional term. It was traditional in those days for Maine governors to only serve up to two terms. And so he was terming out at the end of 1924, early 25. And this gave way to a Republican primary. The moderate candidate whom Baxter favored was the mayor of Augusta, a man named Frank Farrington. But he was opposed by Ralph Owen Brewster, who was a state senator from Portland. And well, we'll never know for sure. Many factors point to the fact that Brewster, at least tacitly, sought the support of the Klan, both in the crucial Republican primary of that spring and then in the general election. And Brewster overwhelmingly defeated his Democratic opponent, 57% to 42%. His opponent was William R. Pattengall, who was a perennial Democratic candidate. He had run against Baxter in 1922. He had run for other Democratic offices, never winning. But there's a wonderful footnote to this, and that is that Brewster wanted to make sure, once he was governor, that Pattengall never had a chance to run again, and he appointed him, very graciously it appeared, to the state Supreme Court, so that he was out of the running, so to speak.
Ralph, thank you so much for your comment and question. And Earl, tell us about the Ku Klux Klan in Maine in 1924. Who are they targeting?
Well, as Kenneth has said, in Maine, they were primarily targeting newly arrived immigrant populations, as well as some that had been quite established. But primarily, they were looking at Catholics and to a certain degree to Jewish people as well. I remember speaking some years ago in Portland, in part about the Klan, and an elderly woman who was from Dexter, which was where Brewster was from, stood up and gave a remarkable account. Her father had been a Jewish merchant in Dexter, and she said that she and her father stood in the doorway of his store on Main Street in Dexter as a Klan parade went by, which included Brewster in it, and she could never forget that chilling experience.
I want to talk about Congress now, because we have been talking a little bit around this, but this is the year, Kenneth, that Congress passed two really monumental pieces of legislation. One we'll talk about a little bit later, which is the Indian Citizenship Act, but two was the 1924 Immigration Act. Tell me if I'm correct, but I believe that this is the act was the first time the U.S. established even the idea of quotas, a certain number of people allowed from different countries, giving different countries different quotas. Yes?
That's correct. And more significantly, perhaps, those quotas were shifted to exclude more people. We'd already had in the late 19th century the notorious Chinese Exclusion Act, which really prohibited Chinese and other Asians from coming into the country. This 1924 Act amplified that in a way, because it was now going to exclude people from certain parts of Europe in particular that were thought of as undesirable, defective in intelligence, and they would move towards only allowing what they were calling white Nordic people to emigrate. So this is completely in line with the Ku Klux Klan's agenda. So we have a moment where the open borders that had created the so-called melting pot were going to slam shut. I had a very interesting experience a week or so ago of going to the Tenement Museum here in New York City, where they have a wonderful program to show what immigration meant in New York City, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century. And we actually went into an apartment in a tenement, and the lecturer gave a very clear demonstration of what happened. This building had been filled with families, each family, three small rooms. After 1924, the building was essentially empty because no more specifically Italians at that time were coming into the country. Italians were considered genetically inferior, dangerous, crime-ridden, the connection to the mafia. So this was a reflection of the idea that we want to keep out of America the people who are causing all the problems and who aren't as intelligent, civilized as us. And I have to say here, we can't talk about this without talking about a very, very important factor in all of this, which was the prominence, the wide prominence of the eugenics movement in America in the 1920s. Eugenics meaning we want to somehow only produce, because they were beginning to understand genetics, we only want to keep those people who will improve the breeding stock, in essence. And that was considered to be white Nordic people. Italians were not desirable. Eastern Europeans were not desirable. Jews were not desirable. So this was all part of the incredibly conservative, isolationist, and I would even say white supremacist DNA in America at the time.
And you know what? I really want to hear from Earl in terms of how the Immigration Act affected Maine, but I'm looking at my clock. We need to go to a break, so I'll ask you about that when we come back from the break, Earl. We are talking about the year 1924 on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the year 1924, what was happening in Maine and across the nation and its resonance today. With me, Earl Shettleworth, who is Maine State historian, and Kenneth C. Davis, author of the series Don't Know Much About History. Share your comments and questions by a quick email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. So as promised, Earl, I wanted to ask you what the impact, if at all, the Immigration Act of 1924 had on Maine.
Well, I think as Kenneth has said, on the national level, there's no question the door was largely shut to many groups of people, not only coming nationally, but also those who were coming to Maine. If you look back very briefly on the development of Maine immigration, it really starts prior to the Civil War with large numbers of the Irish coming either through Canada or directly to Maine. In the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And then after Civil War, we have a big influx of French Canadian people from Quebec, largely to work in the textile industry and to some degree the shoe industry. And then in the late 19th and early 20th century, you have a whole plethora of different groups coming. In the case of my own family, my mother's family, they were Danish immigrants who came to Portland in the 1890s. But immigrants from the late 19th and early 20th century coming into Maine could come from almost any part of Europe or Eastern Europe or Russia. And it was all these groups brought their culture, their trades, their skills, and they enrich the Maine of their time, and their descendants continue to enrich Maine today.
Kenneth, the other big law passed by Congress, the Indian Citizenship Act, what did it do and what did it not do?
Well, essentially it did what it says, gave citizenship to the people who were most American of all, Native Americans. They had been excluded from citizenship up until this point. And that, of course, meant that in the 1924 election, Native Americans could and did vote. What it certainly didn't do was improve the basic lot of Native Americans in this country at the time. It was symbolically very, very significant. I don't think we can say it really changed life for most of the very impoverished Native Americans who had been pushed onto reservations where resources were often scarce until they discovered that there was oil or gold underneath those reservations, and then the situation changed. But it's, you know, it is a signal point in American history. It is one of these moments that we are progressing past the very, very narrow ideas of what America means to a broader sense. And that's why it's 1924 is interesting in a lot of ways, because the first 20 to 24 years of the 20th century was the rise of the progressive era in America. We had changes in laws that changed some working conditions on the state level. We had, of course, the allowing women to vote had happened in this time. So it was a period of progressive advance for a lot of American ideas. That really got its, the doors were shut on progressivism, primarily because of what we've already talked about, World War I, the Spanish flu, the fear of things coming from outside, and the desire to go back to some version of America, an idealized version that didn't include all these others. I would add on in terms of the Native Americans in the culture at that time, I mentioned eugenics earlier. Among the groups that were being sterilized, and sterilization was happening in states like Vermont, Native Americans and French Canadians that Earl just mentioned were among those who were being singled out for sterilization in this period in the Enlightened North. So it was a period where these ideas of who is American, what should be American, were being narrowly cast in a very conservative way.
Earl, so the Indian Citizenship Act formally gave Indigenous Americans the right to vote. However, we just did a program on Charles Norman Shea, Maine hero, came home from World War II, Penobscot, medic, saved countless lives at Omaha Beach, Silver Star recipient, came home from World War II, and was not allowed to vote in Maine. So although the Indian Citizenship Act gives the right to vote nationally, it is not granted here in Maine, is it?
Not for some time. It's not for several years until after World War II that our Native American populations are given the opportunity to vote. I wanted to just also pick up again on Ken's comment about progressivism. It was a very strong but short-lived movement. It gained its emphasis in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt ran as a third-party candidate on what was called the Bull Moose Party, but it was really the Progressive Party. And it really ended in 1924. It's the final push of the progressives was when Robert La Follette ran for president, and in Maine only received about 6% of the vote. There's a very interesting study by the Maine historian Elizabeth Ring on the short-lived Maine progressive movement published by the university many years ago that's worth looking at.
I want to talk about some fun, specific things about Maine, Earl.
Yes.
I understand one of the reasons we can visit some of the great forts in Maine is because of something happened in 1924. Explain that.
Yes. Well, of course, the governor at the time was Governor Percival P. Baxter. And we think of Governor Baxter as the great champion of natural areas in Maine. Certainly, before he was governor, while he was governor, he campaigned to the legislature to acquire Mount Katahdin and to create a state reserve there, a state park. That didn't succeed, and as we know, later on, beginning in the early 30s and continuing to the 1950s, he ended up acquiring Mount Katahdin and the 200,000 acres around it for Baxter State Park. But in 1924, and I think part of it is due to the fact that his father had been a very distinguished historian. James P. Baxter was for 30 years the president of the Maine Historical Society. So Baxter grew up with a real understanding and appreciation for Maine's history. And so in 1924, after World War I, the Secretary of War in Washington decided to deaccession, to sell, to dispose of many of the 19th and early 20th century fortifications, particularly the coastal fortifications, because the technology had changed during World War I, and these were really outmoded fortifications. So as a result, the War Department contacted the state. Governor Baxter learned of the availability of many of the coastal forts, great forts like from Fort McCleary in Kittery all the way up to Fort Knox in Prospect across from Bucksport. And these were being offered to the state at fire sale prices, anywhere from like $500 to $2,000. Baxter recognized not only the historical importance of these forts for the state to acquire them at virtually token amounts, but also the fact that they would be great boons to tourism. And so indeed, during the latter part of his administration, he had in those days to get the approval of the governor's council, they acquired the forts, the historic forts that we now have as part of the park system along the coast.
And something pretty neat happened in Portland as well. They didn't set out to do something for historians of the future. They were just trying to get people to pay taxes, but it turns out to have been a gold mine, right?
Well, this is what happened. In 1923, Portland switched from its mayoratorial form of government. They adopted a new charter, and that charter created a more up-to-date system of local government known as the city manager council form of government. One of the first things that that new government did was to do a survey of all of the taxable properties in Portland. And part of that survey, carried out in 1924, was for the city to photograph every taxable structure in Portland. This is thousands of buildings, street by street. And that at the time was a very sort of practical way to have a record of what was standing on a particular property and how much it might be valued and whether it might change or not for further taxation. Fast forward to 100 years, and that 1924 tax survey of Portland is absolutely invaluable as a historic record of what the city looked like a century ago.
That's right, because there were photographs, right, of every single building.
Yeah, thousands of photographs. And the city fortunately had preserved those records over a century of time. And the Maine Historical Society, with its wonderful Maine Memory Network program, partnered with the city and the Greater Portland Landmarks, got support, financial support from a number of different individuals and organizations. And every one of those photographs was digitally scanned and put into the Maine Memory Network. And you can go on today. All you need to do is just type in 1924 Portland tax records. And up will come the form that you can fill out, either the exact address if it's your property, or maybe you want to look at a street or a neighborhood or whatever, and it's all there. And as an architectural historian interested in Portland, there's hardly a week goes by that I don't use that record, and I know many other people do as well. It's like a time trip back a century ago.
As though there aren't enough reasons to spend some time on Maine Memory Network. Now we know that every single building in Portland was photographed in 1924. And oh boy, I had some fun yesterday afternoon, Earl, looking at those photographs. So really sort of a time capsule for those people who care about Portland, Maine. You know, I want to talk to both of you all so much about the increasing wealth gap that was emerging in 1924, lessons learned from 1924, but we do need to go to another break. We also want to ask you in the audience, wondering if you heard your grandparents or great-grandparents talk about the year 1924, or just specifically the mid-1920s, and what lessons you think we need to take with that time for today. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or go on social media. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the year 1924. 100 years later, what lessons from that year do we need to be thinking about? Our guest today, Earl Shuttleworth, who's Maine State historian, and Kenneth C. Davis, you know his Don't Know Much About History books. Give us a call. You still have time, 1-800-399-3566, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Kenneth, reading about the 1920s, it was a time when wealth disparity grew. Wealth disparity, according to statistics, the top 1% went from owning 12% of the country to the GDP to 19%, which seems kind of quaint by today's standards, but that was pretty dramatic. But that regular Americans were getting poorer during the 1920s. And I'm wondering, it's so interesting to me to read about that now, that this was a time of great wealth, but also great hardship in America generally. Kenneth, are you there? Can you hear me?
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that one was for me. Forgive me. You know, wealth inequity, inequality has been with us for a long time, not only in America, but everywhere. But yes, absolutely. This was a period of, you know, we think of the great period of the robber barons in the late 19th century, but you have the accumulation of wealth at this time by men like Rockefeller, Standard Oil coming along. And these are great corporate entities being created in the early 20th century. And they were essentially also then buying the Senate. The Senate at one point at this time was called Billionaire's Row. Or Millionaire's Row, perhaps, at that time. So the disparity was once again very real. And of course, if we look to parts of the country, the southern states, the former Confederacy, where formerly enslaved people were either locked into the land again with sharecropping or having their land just taken from them, these were all aspects of what was going on in the country at the time. Women were coming into the workforce, no question about that. Women were had achieved a degree of a different sense of place in American society. Secretaries were using these new machines called typewriters. So there were, you know, clear changes in a positive way, but the accumulation and of wealth was still being concentrated in the hands of a few, just as it is today. One of many parallels we can see between 1924 and 2024. And of course, that kind of concentration of wealth and people pouring money into something called Wall Street in the 1920s, because it seemed to be an endless pot of riches, was going to soon come to a very, very sharp and tragic end. Because none of the regulations that exist after the Great Crash existed before the Great Crash. And so a period of intense speculation, the growth of the auto industry, as Earl mentioned later, were adding to the wealth of few Americans. And when that came crashing down in 1929, it was going to affect all Americans.
And Earl, what was the economic situation for most people living in Maine in 1924? Was Maine a poor state?
I wouldn't call it a poor state. I mean, I think that the traditional economic activities that I mentioned at the very beginning of the program, the farming, the fishing, the logging, those were still important economic factors in Maine, along with, of course, the industries, particularly like the textile industry, the shoe industry. But I think there clearly was this big gap between people of modest and middle income and a small number of very wealthy people. Primarily, of course, this was spotlighted along the coast of Maine with the great summer colonies. And you had some of the wealthiest people in America, as they do now, 100 years ago, were spending their summers in mega mansions along the coast of Maine in resort areas. One had only, for example, to go to Mount Desert and consider in the mid-1920s that on one hillside in Seal Harbor, you have John D. Rockefeller Jr., who he and his father, of course, control the Standard Oil Company and you know, vast oil resources. And then at the very same time, right across the way on another hillside, Edsel Ford, the son of Henry Ford, is building Skylands, which is now Martha Stewart's summer home. Here are two of the scions of American industry looking at each other's summer houses across the way.
We'll go to Glenn, who's calling from Newport. Hi, Glenn. Go ahead.
Well, I had a question about Maine agriculture. Can you fill us in on acreage and sort of marketing and stuff for potatoes, apples, blueberries? and other Maine agriculture in 1924.
Yeah, should I take you? Want
me? Yes, please, Earl.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry for the to the caller. I don't really have specifics on hand about that, except that I would say that this is a period in which Aroostook continues to be a major potato producer for the American market. And what really makes this possible is that in the late 19th century, railroads are developed well up into Aroostook County, ultimately by the mid-1890s as far as Fort Kent. And those railroads then make it possible to ship the potato crop each year to market in other parts of the country. The potato farming is really becomes a major cash crop and a major economic force.
Mm. I'm reading an article on history.com that's talking about during World War I, U.S. farmers had increased food production. And so after that, prices and demand dropped and many farmers stuck with an oversupply they couldn't sell. So that's not specific to Maine, but really interesting that something could have caused this domino effect. Let's see, an email from Jenny, and apparently, Kenneth, this is your daughter. She says that you mentioned sterilization in Vermont, and Jenny lives in Belfast. She asks, I'm wondering if Earl can talk about the forced sterilization in Maine and the history of Pineland. So was this in 1924, Earl? Was this happening here?
Well, it was a little bit before that. It was in the early 20th century. The state created an institution which generically became known as Pineland, but was known as the Maine institution or the Maine school for the feeble-minded, terrible term in today's world, that was of course where the people from Malaga Island were taken in around 1912.
Mm. And another question. Go ahead, Kenneth.
I'm going to nod in on there and say, when I hear the names Ford and Rockefeller, I also have to bring it back to this history. Henry Ford, of course, being the man who published in English the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in America, this anti-Semitic tract created in Tsarist Russia that then was transferred over to Germany. It came to America before it went to Germany. And Rockefeller was among those who was a proponent of eugenics, this idea that we can create a better race by eliminating and limiting the breeding of so-called inferior people. So this was, part of the whole atmosphere that fed into the 1924 Immigration Act, which was supported and really lobbied for by eugenicists. They believed in this idea that we had to keep out these undesirable, defective people, especially from Eastern Europe. Ironically, of course, 1924 is also the year that Mussolini secures power in Italy, and he was talking about Italians being a sort of master race and restoring their superiority and rebuilding their great empire. So this was not something that just was happening in America. It was happening elsewhere in a rising era of authoritarian leadership around the world.
As we see today.
Exactly what we are seeing today.
Mm. Jen on Facebook asks, could the guest touch on the importance of the railroad network to Maine during this time? Earl, is it impossible to overstate the importance of the railroad network?
The fact is, railroads begin to be developed almost at the beginning of American railroads in the 1830s, but by the 1920s, almost a century later, the railroad network is extensive in Maine. It literally reaches most of the corners of the state, and it is really the major system of public transportation, very effective. Just to give you an example, the Great Union Station was torn down in Portland in 1961. Back in this period of the early 20th century, there were anywhere from 80 to 100 trains passing through that station in a 24-hour period. It was just extraordinary, the amount of railroad activity and the extensive coverage of the whole, almost the whole state, up into Aroostook, into Washington County, into Western Maine, up into Rangeley. There were railroads everywhere.
Great question, Jen. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk to you all a little more broadly about lessons. And one thing that strikes me, Kenneth C. Davis, reading about 1924, is that people were focused, as you say, on eugenics and immigration policy and prohibition. And it's almost as if they have no idea what's coming. They have no idea that the stock market's going to crash and there's going to be the Great Depression. They're focusing on the wrong thing. And so I'm not a historian. It just struck me looking at that. Does that strike you as well? And do you think there are parallels today?
Well, there are always parallels in history. I know people like to say history repeats, but it's not a perfect cycle. It's often echoes. And we're seeing some echoes of 1924 today in 2024. First to the crash, I would say, I mentioned it earlier, Wall Street was essentially unregulated at the time. People with very little money were pouring their whatever money they had into a stock market that was filled with speculation and corruption. Some of the famous Ponzi schemes. There was a man named Charles Ponzi comes about at this time. So no, people were thinking that this is an endless road to riches when they were looking at the stock market and trains and cars. People had more mobility in America at the time than they ever had before. That, again, on the more positive side, there was a very popular song after World War I that said, how are you going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen gay Paris? So Americans were thinking, well, this is great if we can just keep this going and I can put money into the stock market and I'll be as rich as Rockefeller someday. No one was looking 5 years ahead and saying, gee, we're going to be selling apples for a nickel on the street.
Earl.
If I could just add to that from a personal note, my mother graduated from Colby in 1927 and became an English teacher. And very quickly thereafter, she acquired her first automobile, a sign of independence. And she also invested in city service oil stock in the late 20s, which then, of course, she lost in the crash of 1929. And from therein, till the day she passed away in 1997, she never will put another penny in the stock market.
Yeah, my grandfather would not. Yeah, my grandfather would not. Earl, we have just about a minute left. I'm wondering if you have anything to add about bigger lessons of 1924 as we enter the second half of 2024.
I'm not sure that I'm ready to do a broad brush. I just want to add one thing that we haven't covered, and this is more from my architectural bias, and that is 1924 is the year that one of Portland's most well-known buildings was built, the Chapman Building, which we now know as the Time and Temperature Building. And when that building went up, it was the second high-rise building in the Monument Square area, the first one being the Fidelity Building. Of course, both of those are now in the process of being retrofitted into apartments, but they were office buildings in those days. And when those buildings went up, my mother could remember in the 20s during that period, they thought that Portland was going to be the new Boston, that these were only the beginning of a whole series of high-rise buildings in downtown Portland. And of course, it took another 40 years before another high-rise building was built in Portland.
I think that's a wonderful way to end the program, but I'm going to have one note. I just looked up the number one song in 1924, George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So Toby would be proud of me for bringing that up, Toby LaBoudelier. So anyway, thank you so much, both of you, joining us. Earl Shuttleworth, Maine's longtime state historian, and Kenneth C. Davis, a best-selling author who wrote the Don't Know Much About History book series. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can always share your thoughts with Maine Calling by using the Maine Public Vox Pop app. Download it, and you can easily record your comments. Tomorrow on the program, for the 4th of July, we listen back to a conversation I just mentioned, our earlier show about war hero and Penobscot tribal member Charles Norman Shea, who just turned 100. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.